Hi, I'm Gary Bauman from Czech in Asia.
And I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
And this is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thank you for listening in to our very first podcast of 2020.
Yes, following up on the two pilot shows of the Southeast Asia Travel Show that we posted on Spotify in December 2019, this is our debut for a new decade. And we're kicking off with a two-part introduction to the 2020s. But more about that in a minute. Firstly, though, Happy New Year to you, Hannah.
Happy New Year.
And we're only halfway through January, and you've already been jumping onto flights.
I have,
yeah. Where have you been, and what have you been up to?
So I've just come back from Bangkok, actually. So I was there for a kind of travel tabletop, and then yesterday they had the big consumer travel fair in Bangkok, and it was really interesting, actually, to see what destinations are hot in Thailand right now, and I think I can conclude it's Japan.
Really?
Definitely. Japan dominated this fair. About half of the stands were either selling Japan tour packages or were from JNTO itself or the regional tourism boards. It's just mad.
Really? So they were booking for Sakura and for winter also?
Exactly, yeah. So booking for Sakura season, and traveling over Songkran, so kind of March, April time, through to the summer months. But it was interesting to compare, you know, how big or not it was to Mata Fair, which is the big consumer fair in Malaysia. And I have to say, whilst I think Thailand agents are a little bit more advanced in terms of more creative itineraries than Malaysian counterparts, the Malaysian travel fair is massive compared to this Bangkok. Right.
And what about ASEAN destinations? Were there many ASEAN?
There were some, yeah. So, I mean, you had the tourism boards. Malaysia was there. Philippines was there. Who else was there? Indonesia as well. So there's definitely that kind of presence, but the hot destination, Japan.
Definitely Japan.
Wiped everything off the board, yeah.
Okay.
So how about you? What have you been up to?
Well, I've been based here in KL. It's been busy actually since Christmas. Been working on a few projects. Most interesting one probably was Brunei, which is not a country I've really dealt with too much.
Nope.
I've been doing some client work, particularly Brunei, which I didn't realize is actually part of two regions. There's two regions to Brunei, and the middle part is separated by Sarawak, the state of Sarawak in Malaysia. So these two regions have long been separated, and to get between the two, you have to go through checkpoints.
Mm-hmm.
So they're building this huge bridge across Brunei Bay, which is being built by, it's jointly being built by the Koreans and the Chinese.
Yeah.
So this bridge will connect the two and will actually open up access to what looks like a beautiful national park in the Temburong region of Brunei. The bridge is supposed to open at some point during 2020, and the tourism industry could well be a beneficiary of that.
Definitely.
And it's quite timely because obviously Brunei this week has been hosting the ASEAN Tourism Forum for all the 10 ASEAN ministers. So, interesting times. The tourism industry there is fledgling. It's very small. It's a very small country, of course.
Yeah.
But there are big opportunities there, I think, and obviously Chinese tour operators and airlines are looking to move into that region because it really offers nature-based tourism, which is relatively untapped.
Yeah, and I'll tell you which airline has really been making moves this year. I think Royal Brunei, actually, are one to watch. Because certainly, I know in Malaysia this year, they're offering really cheap fares to Europe.
Right.
And even at the Bangkok fair yesterday, I saw them advertising. They've got their own stand, all the destinations they're going to. So, yeah, Brunei, one to watch.
I think they were one of the first airlines to be approved a route into the new Beijing Daxing International Airport. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think they definitely want to watch.
Right. So, back to the matter in hand. And we have mined our creative capacities to create our travel wish list for 10 years ahead.
Yeah, it took some thought, but we've put together a list entitled 20 for the 2020s, covering the 20 things that we'd most like to see happen in travel and tourism before the end of 2029. These are featured in no particular order, so we'll be discussing the first 10 items in this show, followed by the second 10 in a twin podcast, and we'll upload both shows together.
Okay, so let's get started on our 20 for the 2020s travel wish list with one of Gary's biggest wants. Number one, governments and tourism boards, stop annual volume setting.
Yeah, this has been a bit of a bete noire of mine in tourism for probably the last half decade or so. In Asia, we've seen tourism and travel become very high profile. We've seen governments identify it as a way for economies to grow. And that's tended to drive them towards setting rather large targets for each year. Right now, as we're in January, we're talking about this. This is annual reporting season. So a lot of the governments and tourism boards in the region are reporting record years last year. It was a very, very, very busy year. But that also leads them to set sometimes targets for the next year that may be a little bit too high, and also really rely too much on volume tourism. We're trying to get away from that.
Well, exactly. I mean, you need to concentrate on the ones that are bringing value, right? You can bring a million tourists, but if they all just spend $100, what's the point?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this reached a high point last year when Tourism Thailand announced that over the next decade, it could be receiving up to 65 million tourists a year. Now, it didn't set that as a target. It actually stated that that's something that could happen on the current charts of growth. It actually then tapered off a little bit, and it drew that down slightly. But that's an enormous figure, and that is really is just not manageable, I wouldn't think. This year, it's the Olympics in Japan. So they've set a target, I think, is 40 million this year. In our country, Malaysia, it's Visit Malaysia a year. So they've set a target of 30 million. These are, they're very rounded figures, and they don't really relate to anything that sounds feasible. And I just think it just generates this idea that tourism is about numbers. When it actually isn't. Tourism is about people, it's about experiences, it's about fun. If you make it too monetized and numerized, it doesn't seem to work.
I think you're right. I think it misses the point. So, come on, 2020 is less volume setting.
So, moving on to number two on our 2020s wish list. And Hannah, this is one of your choices.
Yes.
So, you said Southeast Asia to become the most desirable outbound market pursued by NTOs worldwide. So, I have two questions here. Where are we at the moment on that statement?
Yes.
And where would you like to see us in 10 years' time?
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it, this? Because I think we are seeing nowadays more and more APAC NTOs. And so we're talking places like East Asia, like Korea, like Japan, like Australia. And these, probably because of proximity, really recognize that Southeast Asian market is a big one, is a valuable one. But then you see markets like America, like Europe. And for them, I mean, Southeast Asia barely registers. It's like a little blip on the radar.
I think some of those countries are still going through the China phase, perhaps going through the India phase. They haven't yet figured out that the Indonesia phase, the Vietnam phase, these are happening already.
Exactly. So, you know, what I would love in 10 years' time, and obviously Gary and I are both pretty passionate about Southeast Asia, hence the podcast.
We're a little bit biased.
But yeah, I want NTOs worldwide to kind of wake up and realize this is an affluent market. It's growing. The hunger to travel.
But you attend a lot of travel shows, and you see how this is actually growing. And particularly in the region, we're seeing a lot of interregional travel. But we're also seeing, as you mentioned, in Thailand, Japan is playing a big role. Do you think it will happen in the longer haul market, or do you think this is going to be much more Asia focused?
I don't know. I think it might happen in the longer haul market. Just as they, you know, Indonesia's got such a big growing population as well. And I'll come to that, I think, a little bit later on our wish list. I mean, there are restrictions right now, visa restrictions, talk about it later. But I think that is also kind of hampering the growth. And until things are kind of sorted politically, I think it's hard to see it really happening, I think.
But we remain positive. I mean, we see that the travel consumer, the whole culture has changed in the last decade.
Definitely.
And over the next decade, that will continue. So there will be, from within each country in Southeast Asia, there will be demand to travel.
Always.
It's up to the world to really say, come and join us.
I agree. Yes, I think so. So, number three. And this was one that both Gary and I both thought, actually, this is on our wish list, which is better rail connectivity through Southeast Asia.
I think this is an important element for a number of reasons. One, there are too many flights. This is an issue for climate change. It's an issue for the environment. But also, rail connectivity has become very, very important for certain markets around the world. China's domestic market has really benefited from having a high-speed network. Mm-hmm. Japan really benefits from that. Europe, to a degree, you can travel around Europe, mainland Europe. In the UK, it's very expensive, but you can still do it. But it gives travelers a different option, and it gives that option of traveling across land, obviously, rather than above land, which is an entirely different perspective. And I think as more Southeast Asian travelers are doing train trips in other countries, they should expect to have more in their own region. Now, we are seeing some developments. There's this train coming from China through Laos. There potentially, there is the KL to Singapore high-speed train, but we really don't know what's happening with that. And there are other projects as well. But I do think that Southeast Asia really lacks a really good rail network that would really benefit travelers domestically and internationally.
Yeah, I think so. So, more trains.
Yes, please. Yes, please. Let's have more trains.
And kind of on related note then, I mean, climate change or climate crisis, that's going to have a massive impact on travel, you know, in the 2020s. And we've already seen it happen with Australia, the bushfires there. So Gary's collected number 4 on our list, measurable environmental action, not greenwashing by travel brands.
You mentioned that, Hannah, Australia. I think everybody around the world was watching that over Christmas and New Year and was horrified and scared. Yes. And, you know, our hearts go out to the people of Australia because it must have been absolutely terrifying what's happened there. And whether you believe or you don't believe in climate change, it is very, very obvious that things are happening. And it's not just that. At the same time in Jakarta, we had terrible floods, which I think were the worst floods in a decade or something like that.
Terrible.
In Malaysia, we're seeing the seasons are changing. Mm-hmm. The rain patterns are different than they were, even when we arrived, you know, seven or eight, 9 years ago. Climate is a big issue. What has happened a little bit in the travel sector is if we go back maybe 5 or 6 years, there was a real movement towards your carbon footprint, trying to change, trying to reduce down your carbon footprint. And that sort of got subverted a little bit by the plastics issue. Now, the plastics issue is very important. Don't get me wrong. Our seas and our lands are being ruined by single-use plastics. It's disgusting, and it's killing wildlife, and it's killing people. It's getting into the food chain in Indonesia, for example. But what I don't like to see is that a lot of travel brands have really moved into the single-use plastics. We're getting rid of single-use plastics. Look at how good we are. I don't think that's the issue.
No.
I think there has to be an integrated way of looking at climate change. And I think brands will have to change their behaviors. We're talking about airlines. We're talking about hotels. We're talking about tour operators. Because I think consumers will demand it. I no longer think it would be an option for companies to greenwash and say, look at what we're doing. Because I think consumers will turn around and say, you're not doing enough. We're starting to see that in the actual retail environment and the brand environment.
In the manufacturing
environment. You know, consumers are turning away from brands that they do not think are upholding their responsibility to the environment. I think travel is absolutely going to be in the focus for this. So, yeah, I think travel brands must really up their game. The world needs it.
It does,
So, okay, rant over. So let's move on to item 5 on our 20 for the 2020s wish list. Hannah, and this is your area of expertise. I'm going to defer to you here. You've written down Muslim tourism to become more mainstream. And similarly to the question before, I'm going to ask you two parts to this. Where are we at right now? And where would you like to see us in 10 years' time?
And this is actually an answer that is very similar to my Southeast Asia one. So where are we at right now? I mean, you can see that the Muslim market is growing and growing. It's worth billions of USD and kind of GDP revenue a year. But where we are right now, still not enough NTOs are recognizing that. And for me, it is, it's about inclusivity, actually. It's helping everybody travel in a way that makes them feel comfortable, in a way that they are able to, and in Muslim tourists' case, in a way that's kind of compatible with their faith. And my real hope for the rest of this decade is that more and more NTOs and tour operators and hotels can get in on this, and they can recognize small steps that they can make to make Muslim travelers feel a bit more comfortable in their journey. And, you know, this is a population that is only going to expand. By 2060, 1 in 3 are going to be Muslim. So it's worth jumping on
the bandwagon. 1 in 3 travelers.
One in three in the world.
Right. 1 in 3 people.
That's it. In the world are going to be Muslim. So it is worth jumping in on the bandwagon now and getting in there now.
Yeah.
And building up this infrastructure. You know, it takes time.
Yeah. And before you answer the question about where you'd like to see us in the end of the decade.
Yeah.
We discussed this on one of our pilot shows that you did a report last year where you looked at NTOs around the world and their online readiness in terms of Muslim travelers.
Yes.
You're going to do the report again this year.
I will,
Do you think you'll have noticed much of a change in a year?
I think there will have been a small change, but again, I feel that this is probably more the APAC NTOs who are taking notice still.
Right.
I still don't think that European tourism boards are taking much action at all towards it.
Right.
So I think we will see a change in the rankings. I think people, you know, I just read an article this afternoon about Singapore Tourism Board who said they're ramping up their efforts to attract Muslim travellers this year. So I think we'll see a change in that ordering.
Yeah.
But will we see a fundamental change? I don't think so by the end of this
And I'm going to interject again. So just before the end of this decade, this could be one of those trends that comes from Asia. So we might see that Muslim travel is becoming more accepted, more promoted.
Yeah.
It's more inventive from within Asia. And that might actually then spread out around the world.
Yeah, I hope so. I think so. I think there are some really innovative ways of promoting destinations to Muslim tourists in APAC. So yeah, let's lead the way, Asia.
That would be great. That would be great. That's a real travel wish for us, right?
Yeah. So number six, now this is a personal plea from Gary. More vegetarian meals on airlines, please. Self-explanatory, but I think there might be a little bit more to it. Go on.
Well, yeah, I've been vegetarian for the best part of, 25 years, I think.
Wow.
And I still get frustrated when I get told by airline staff on board flights that you must book a vegetarian meal in advance.
Yep.
I don't understand why.
No.
The percentage of vegetarian travelers, particularly on some of the routes in this region, if you're talking about Indian travelers, for example, is very high.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to book. And now, okay, I understand that that's a rule and everybody should abide by it.
Hmm.
But some airlines, and I will say that the Middle Eastern carriers are very good at this, always have spare capacity. They will always try and find something for you.
Hmm.
Other airlines, and I won't name them, simply refuse to do that.
Really?
I don't understand why there's this difference. You know, if you're traveling intercontinental, if you're going on long haul, you know, there should be a way to deal with this.
Yeah.
And that's basically it. I just think that we have to be more inclusive.
Yeah.
Because it's not vegan, it's vegetarian. You know, there's all sorts of different types that you can pre-order.
Yes.
But if you haven't ordered, you don't get anything.
Yeah, controversial thought. Why not make all meals vegetarian?
Well,
then everybody could eat them, right?
Well, that would be environmentally friendly.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, the Oscars was vegetarian this year. Did you notice that?
No.
The Oscar ceremony, I think it was actually vegan. The food that was served to everybody at the Oscars this year was a vegan meal.
Veganuary.
See, if they can do it, airlines can definitely do it.
Definitely.
Okay, another rant over. So moving on, we're on to number 7th on our wish list, and this is one of your choices, Hannah.
Mm.
You've said, and I think you've alluded to this already, that you'd like to see this decade an easing of visa restrictions for Vietnam, Indonesia, and Philippines.
Yes.
Now, how can that issue best be addressed?
Well, that's a tricky one, isn't it? I mean, it is all very political, but I just think that, you know, Vietnam, Indonesia, and Philippines, they've got huge populations of people. I keep saying a growing middle class. They've got the ability and the desire to spend. So why not make it a little bit easier for them to travel to other countries? I mean, and right now, if you compare, I think Malaysia and Singapore are in the top 10. Is it top 10, I think? Or Malaysia's 12th or something for the number of countries that they can visit.
Passport index.
Yeah, the passport index. Vietnam, Indonesia, and Philippines are right down the bottom somewhere. But they've got huge potential. And I think countries are being perhaps overly protective or overly cynical, that these are maybe countries where people are going to overstay.
Yeah.
And so they don't want to open them up. So in particular, you've got, you know, the Schengen regions, Europe. And for all three of these, they need visas.
Yeah.
But if you ease those restrictions, I think you would see a huge amount of outbound travel from these destinations to there. I mean, Vietjet itself is you know, we were talking about, it's such a ambitious airline, isn't it? It's launching so many new routes, but it's launching routes towards the USA.
Yeah.
Why not launch routes towards Europe?
And I agree. I think I would agree with that. I think Vietnam, one of the reasons perhaps that the visa regulations haven't quite caught up with the growth of travel is because the growth of travel has happened so spectacularly fast, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years.
Yes.
And I think countries like Japan are really picking up on this because they are really realizing that the potential of travel that will come from Vietnam. I think other countries will follow behind on that one.
Yeah.
Philippines and Indonesia, it may be perhaps a bit more of a slow burn. I'm not sure. That will depend on flight routes, presumably, how quickly they can scale those up.
Mm.
But I would tend to agree that I think over the next decade, Vietnam will zoom up that passport index.
Yep. So
that's our travel wish.
That's our travel wish, our travel prediction. So talking about airlines then, flying is a key part of the travel experience in Southeast Asia, both for business and leisure. So Gary, you've chosen airports that work. More Changi departure, less Changi arrival as topic 8 on our 20 for the 2020s. Tell us more.
Well, there's no doubt. Changi Airport wins awards every single year.
It's world-class.
It's a fantastic airport, and it has been for a long time.
Mm.
And the one thing I do like about Changi is they continue to improve particularly the departure experience.
Yes.
We get new terminals. I think Jewel opened, was it last year or the year before?
Yeah.
Terminal 4, I think, opened the year before, maybe the year before that. They are very, very spacious. They are very well designed. They have great facilities.
Yeah.
They tend to be quite frictionless.
You know,
you can scan your passport, you can scan your boarding card, and you can go through. The departure experience at Changi is, as you say, world class, and even better than that, I would say. There are very few airports that compete with it.
Yeah.
Another airport that I do like is Doha in Qatar. I think that is fabulous.
Yes.
But generally, airports don't do what they're supposed to do. They are not efficient.
No.
There are too many queues, and there are too many facilities that just haven't been well thought out.
Yeah.
I would have to say that Changi's downfall is the arrival experience. And I think that has perhaps been because of the volume of travelers that have been going into Singapore over the last couple of years. You do tend sometimes to have to wait quite a long time in line, which for an airport of that quality isn't quite good enough, I don't think.
Yep.
They probably need to add a few more counters. Mm. That would solve the problem.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they'll be doing that. Singapore is usually
pretty efficient
on these kinds of things.
Yes.
But I would like to see airports better designed. I was reading a report just before Christmas that one of the airports in Japan, I can't remember which one it is using behavioral science methodologies to actually work out in advance where the peak travel flows of passengers are through the airport at 24 hours a day so that it can try and manage them.
Yeah.
And it can then also automatically move you to different parts. It can open up different services. Whether
smart.
This works, I don't know. Yeah, it's very much the sort of smart city model. But it would be nice to see more airports doing that, actually using technology in a beneficial way rather than just scanning your face and thinking that that's the answer.
Yes.
It's not. It's actually looking at ways to actually assuage the problem of too many people in one place at one time, which airports do have, particularly peak travel periods, like we're coming up to Chinese New Year.
Yeah.
And you're going to see a lot of airport queues over the next few weeks.
Yes. Nice.
Right, I've got that off my chest. So it's back to you, Hannah. Our wish list item that you would like to say is... Now this one... okay.
Yeah.
It's a marketing issue. Destinations need to manage Instagrammability, but without creating over-tourism.
Yeah, I mean, this is another hot topic, isn't it? So again, it's kind of linking to sustainability. And it's really that, how can you balance, obviously, you want tourists to go and experience places, you want them to take pictures, you want them to tell their friends and family. But what happens when they all just take pictures of the same place, you know, and so there's... resorts in Bali where everybody lines up to, you know, take a certain spot, or you know, it's just too much and everybody sees it and they all have to go to that exact spot on Instagram so they can get that exact picture.
Yeah. Instagram's been an interesting one, particularly over the last 4 or 5 years, because hotels, museums, entertainment centers, restaurants, they've all, well, not all of them, but a lot of them have been specifically designed now to be Instagrammable.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's fine, but I think destinations have to figure out how, well, really it's spreading the love, I guess, isn't it? It's encouraging them to visit other destinations or promoting that, but without also running the risk that everybody's going to go to that destination.
And the power of social media really works. I was in London over the holidays and I was walking through Soho 2 days running at about 2:30 in the afternoon. And there was a huge queue outside what was a very small bakery.
Yeah.
Both days, right around the block. And it was mostly tourists from a lot of different countries.
Yeah.
And they were queuing up for these outsized cookies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only way that people would have known about this, I'm pretty sure, is through
social
Instagram,
media.
Right?
Yeah.
But the queues were huge. And like, it was, it wasn't warm, and it was raining one of the days. But the same time every day, people were queuing outside for these cookies.
Yes.
And you just think, well, that's okay. And maybe the cookies are great. But that's a long queue.
Yeah.
Is Instagram that powerful? I think it really is.
It is, it is. So, I mean, I would love, and there's no magic bullet for this. There's no kind of cure, I guess, that anybody has thought of yet. But I would love 2020s to be the time when destinations try and figure out how can they balance that
kind
of rush towards places. And
I mean, to be fair, Thailand has been trying to do this. It's been trying to promote, not necessarily Instagrammability, but certainly some of its secondary and tertiary natural sites to try and move people away from the key sites. But I guess, you know, the danger there is that as soon as one of these places becomes very Instagrammable,
everyone will go there.
The crowd moves there.
Yeah. So no easy answer there. So ranked 10th on our 2020s travel wish list is better hotel coffee, please. Over to you.
Well, I do feel that I've spent quite a lot of this episode ranting, but I'm going to do it again. Better hotel coffee, please. Well, I have to say I'm an avowed coffee snob. I do love coffee. I didn't actually as a child, and I didn't as a teen. I actually found the coffee bug, and I was living and working in El Salvador in Central America for almost a year. And one of my students, her family owned a coffee farm. And at that time, which is 1997, the global coffee price had collapsed. And she was desperately trying to sell her coffee into America, and she thought I was American. So she brought me a huge amount of coffee, which was absolutely amazing, in the hope that I would take it back to America and sell it.
Yeah.
So that's where I got the coffee bug from. But one of the things that I tend to find is that hotels don't take coffee very seriously. And a lot of the coffee gets served at breakfast, in the afternoon, in the evening, is very substandard. I know this is a cost issue.
Yeah.
But some of the better hotels are as at fault as this as some of the cheaper hotels. And I think that if you're paying a certain room rate,
you
know, they talk about quality, they talk about the personalization, they talk about the service and the luxury of this hotel. And yet you're drinking coffee, which you probably wouldn't be served in one of the coffee chains.
Yes.
I just don't think it's good enough. And it's a bit of a personal mantra for me. I would like to see all hotels do better coffee.
Better coffee, vegetarian meals.
Yeah, well, these are travel wish lists.
Travel wish lists. Exactly.
I can say what I like.
So that was fun and roll on part two. We'll be back with the second half of our 20 for the 20s travel wish list shortly. But in the meantime, we'd love to hear your thoughts on your own travel wishes for the new decade. So please get in touch with us via Facebook at the SEA Travel Show and Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
And we're also on Instagram now, SEA Travel Show. And we have our own LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
We're on them all. Plus, we'll have a brand new website, email newsletter, and a couple of extra surprises to tell you about very soon.
So thanks again for listening into part one of our 20 for the 20s travel wishlist show. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again very soon.
See you.
See you.